Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we ask brilliant educators everything you've ever wondered about teaching English language learners. I'm your host, Liesl Koop. I'm an ENL teacher and resource specialist with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Okay, listeners, welcome to another episode. Thank you for coming back to listen to another episode. We have two really important questions. Our burning questions for today are these. The first is, how can we create equity for L's during distance learning and have that carry back into classroom learning? And our second question is, how can teachers of L's cultivate resilience while navigating through more challenges than ever? And to address these questions and have a conversation about these questions, I have an incomparable guest, someone who I deeply admire and whose work has really impacted my practice as a teacher and just my practice as showing up as a human being with my family and my friends and the teachers that I serve. Our guest today is Elena Aguilar. Hi, Elena.
Hi, Liesl. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for saying yes. When my supervisor, Tanya, said, you know, create your dream guest list for your podcast, who would you have on it? You were one of the first names that came to mind, and I'm still kind of in shock that you were able to make this work with your schedule. Hopefully I don't, you know, squeal or hyperventilate or get too excited. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You are welcome. I'm really looking forward to this opportunity to connect in this way. It's really meaningful to me as well.
Elena, for our listeners who aren't familiar with you and the work that you do, can you please tell them your title, your position? What do you do right now for work?
Sure. Well, every time I go through U.S. immigrations or any immigration going into any country, you have to fill out a form and it asks you what your profession is. And I always put teacher. That's not my official title right now, but it's the title that most resonates. I was a teacher and a coach in the Oakland Public Schools for 20 years. And that's the identity, professional identity, that most resonates for me. My current official title and role is I am the founder and president of Bright Morning Consulting. This is a small organization that designs and facilitates transformational learning experiences for adults, primarily those who work in schools, for the purpose of or for those who are invested in creating spaces and schools and organizations that are equitable, that are just. And so that's my current title. I suppose another title could be the other one that resonates most deeply, in addition to teacher, is writer. So I am a writer. I've written 5 books. I kind of can't believe that, but 5 books. And that's the other professional identity that I most associate with.
Thank you. And I'm sure that people are going to want to seek out some of the resources that you share. And so at the end of our conversation, we can share some places where people can find that information. For those who don't know, what are your special areas of interest or research?
I would say the overarching area of interest is how do we create communities that are healthy and resilient and equitable, or perhaps that are spaces of liberation? And so for me, there's a little bit of a difference between equity, justice, and liberation. And my ultimate goal is to create and be in spaces characterized by liberation. And so that's the prime. How do we create communities? So how do we create teams, schools, organizations, spaces that are resilient, that can manage, that can experience adversity and challenge and rebound better than they were before? How can we create spaces where there is deep acceptance, although I'm not sure the word is acceptance, of who we individually are? Not acceptance, it's embracing of who each individual person is, who we are as a community. That to me is a characteristic of a liberated community. So in perhaps more direct, straightforward terms, my area of special interest or research is equity, resilience, community building, team building, and then adult learning. How do we as adults learn and support the learning of others so that we can create these spaces?
I love that. And I hope that some of our listeners have had the opportunity to take advantage of some of the offerings that you've had. Recently, you've had a lot of free webinars. I had the great privilege of attending the Art of Coaching in Boston with Janet Baird, which was amazing. And I actually know one of my colleagues at another Arburn in the Rochester area in New York is leading a book study about the Onward book that you wrote. So there's so many different pieces to what your team does and to how that can impact not just teachers of ELLs, but all teachers and all kids. So we're just so thrilled to be able to, I'm just honored to have this conversation on behalf of the teachers that I serve with you today.
Thank you.
In the past, I believe that you have done some work with English language learners. Can you talk a little bit about what you did with English language learners and how that came to be?
Sure. I would say starting with all of my experiences teaching, I never had a single year when I didn't have English learners in my class. My very first year of teaching, actually, I taught in a very rural community where I was teaching high school students, and most of them actually were newcomer students who had received very little formal education in their home countries. And it was actually that experience. I was a substitute teacher and I was in long-term sub positions. I had one position for 4 months, a maternity leave position. And it was actually that experience teaching that group of students that made me realize this is something I want to do all the time. I don't want to just be a substitute teacher while I'm pursuing graduate school. And then from that community, I moved to Oakland, California, where I still live 25 or something years later. And again, all of the classes, all the students ever that I ever had here were English learners, varying levels of being an English learner. So that was, and then as a coach, Oakland, I worked in the Oakland Public Schools, as I said, for 20 years. And I don't know what the percentage is of English learners, but it's changed, but somewhere between 40 and 60% of the students in this district are English learners, depending on the year. And so there was no way to be a teacher or a coach and think about equity without also needing to think about and address the issues for English learners.
Which is the perfect segue into my very first question, which is, how do you define equity?
So first of all, thank you for having that as the first question. That should always be the first question when we talk about equity, because otherwise it's one of these terms that is used and used often without definition, which is the perfect entry point for having conflict when we don't define terms that we're commonly using, and especially those like equity. So the definition I use of equity is that every child gets whatever they need, whatever they deserve to be successful and to thrive in school every day. And so every child, every day, regardless of their race or ethnicity, regardless of the languages spoken at home, regardless of socioeconomics or gender or sexual orientation or ability. Every child, every day, period. That's what equity is. It's ambitious. I know. That's overwhelming. It's like, really? And yes, we got to have big ambitions.
We have something to work toward, and we have a lot of work to do, but thankfully there are a lot of people doing the work, which is great. So particularly for L's, what do you think equity looks like and sounds like in the physical classroom or school environment?
So I think I want to start just a little bit more broadly, and because this question to me is relevant for any group that has been historically underserved or that is marginalized, what equity looks like for those groups begins with that who they are, perhaps as a group, but there's no way to know a group without knowing individuals, that who they are is known, and that their needs and wants and experiences are known, that their stories are known. Because I also want to acknowledge there's a difference. I want to perhaps caution us when thinking about English learners to remember that there's so many differences and nuances within groups and within their needs. And so a group of English learners, students who are coming from contexts in which there were wars, civil wars, perhaps where they were in refugee or displacement camps, perhaps those that have literacy in their first language or in another language versus those who don't. There's so many distinctions to make that I think it's useful to go more broad and think about what do groups of people from any underserved or marginalized background need in order to have equitable access to education. And the first thing is that they need to be known, they need to be listened to. And so that's where I'd start. And that's where I'd start also, again, as I just referenced with thinking about English learners, is that who they are is known beyond, in California at least, there's a way of classifying English learners, right? And they end up with these numbers. It's like they're not just a number, not a level, not an assignation of mastery towards a certain level of proficiency. We need to know who they are, what their stories are, what their needs are, what their strengths and their communities are, and then design in response to that.
I really appreciate you being explicit about that, because as an organization that supports teachers who are learning how to work with English learners and their families, we get asked all the time, well, what's the first thing I need to focus on with my English language learners? Or what's the most important thing? And like you said, it's not this homogeneous group. It's every kid, every family, every speaker of any language has different needs. And I really appreciate you bringing the idea that we need to know the child before we can move forward to the forefront of the conversation. If you think about L programming that you've seen as a coach or a teacher in the schools that you've worked in, what are the features of the most equitable programs that you've seen? What stands out and makes those programs really equitable?
So I'll go back and I'll start with what I was just talking about, which is knowing people, knowing individuals, listening to their stories. And I would say they're in places where I see more equitable learning experiences, they're places where I know that individuals are known. When I talk to teachers, they know the stories of different students. They know what they need. They know that some students have strengths and particular knowledge about certain things, and others are struggling with this or that. I can't emphasize enough this central concept in terms of equity or justice, which is to be known. That's one of the greatest damages done in systems of oppression, is that people are, you know, stereotyped, or people are dehumanized and seen monolithically, and their full humanity isn't recognized. And so what that means and how that translates into a classroom with English learners includes that a student's family, student's community, that their complexity, their full humanity is recognized and celebrated, that there's space for students and their families to bring who they are and what they know, that there's an absence of a deficit thinking model, right? And so deficit thinking model is, you know, oh, these poor children who don't speak English and they're coming from struggle or war-torn countries. And that's a deficit model. That's a model which can also echo some of the dangerous representations or manifestations during colonialism and post-colonialism of this sort of white savior going in to take care of, to save these, you know, underprivileged, I'm using that word sort of in quotes because I don't like that word, you know, or disadvantaged, again, another word I don't like, or at risk, another word I don't like, communities. They're not. They have their own strengths and their own resilience. And yes, in addition to that, it's true that some or many of those students and communities have been through trauma that is really needs to be acknowledged. But we also often miss what's brought, the resilience, the strength. And so how does a teacher, coach, school leader surface, name, acknowledge, recognize, celebrate that? And I think one of the things that we need to do to create equitable schools is shift the power dynamic of who is listening, who's making decisions. And so how does that kind of equity happen? Sit down and listen to students and listen to their parents and ask them, what do you need? What can we do? What do you know? How can we honor your child? So that's a sort of global and more holistic response to the question. And then to be really, really specific, because it needs to be said, the most equitable programming I've seen is one where students are speaking. And I'm just, unfortunately, and sadly, surprised by how many classrooms I go into that have high numbers of English learners where students are not talking, and where the teacher still does all the talking. And so I just want to sort of echo back or reiterate that, like, we know that English learners need to have opportunities to talk. And I'm not even talking about what language, I'm just saying they need to talk. Like, they need to talk. And so just want to name that really explicitly again.
Thank you. That's something that we talk about on my team all the time. How can we encourage teachers to let kids talk in whatever language they want to speak in? How can we get kids speaking about what they're learning about? Because we know as adults, we learn and we, you know, construct knowledge when we're talking about these things with each other. And if we're not giving our kids, especially our English language learners, the opportunity to do that, they're not getting the full benefit of what could actually be happening in their classrooms. Which kind of leads to my next question. When we're talking about this sudden shift to distance learning, and I'm going to say that in quotes because I think distance learning is a different concept than what is actually suddenly having to happen right now. When we're talking about this kind of online learning, what forces are at play that are working against equitable access and opportunities for English learners?
I think there are so many of the obvious ones. One of the ways that I think about responding to this question, and there's so many questions that are coming up for which we don't have the answers and we don't know, and we as educators, as leaders, are being put into situations in which we need to sort of learn and process really fast. So the first way I think about answering this question is I use everything I know about the English learners I've taught to put myself in their shoes and to imagine, okay, so I perhaps call to mind a couple or a few students who I knew perhaps better than others. And I think, how would Brenda be feeling in this situation right now? And that helps me better understand the forces that are working against equitable access, because I can think about the much larger context that Brenda would be in, the anxiety and insecurity about her parents losing their jobs, which they would have. They would have been people who would have lost their jobs right away. They were temporary workers and people who cleaned office buildings that would have closed down, right? So I can put myself into the shoes of one specific person and think about their experience. I can put myself into the shoes of another student who did come from a refugee camp and from many years of civil war in his country. And I can imagine how this uncertain context and just all of the anxiety could have been playing out in his home, in his community. So that helps me think about what is working. It's the much larger context, which is about the intersection of identity markers and experiences and the economic instability and fears. But one thing that comes to mind is perhaps even before asking this question, I push myself always to start with strengths, assets, opportunities. What are we building on? What skills do students already have? And so, for example, I know that many students who are English learners, many of them, their parents perhaps, or their families, connect with families in another country via WhatsApp. I don't know what, you know, WhatsApp I feel like has transformed international communication. I'm on it all the time. I have really good friends in Kenya. I have family in Costa Rica. I have a family all over the place. And we're always on it communicating and sending, you know, my aunts in Costa Rica are like, I'm like every day they're sending little videos and funny things and this and that. And so when I think about the role that cell phones now play in the ability of folks who, even folks who have very little financial resource, my friends in Kenya have extremely limited financial resource and they have a phone and they connect by WhatsApp. So I do think that there is some comfort and facility with connecting in that way, and even with this concept of connecting over distance. And so I want to start with thinking about strengths and assets, and at least starting with a question of, you know, I wonder if for those children, those students, there's actually already, they are familiar with, they're used to not being near many people that they love and care about. In fact, there's ways in which they have been living virtually with close family for many years, perhaps. And so I keep saying perhaps, because I also want to be cautious that I'm not making assumptions. But that might be something that I start off with asking when I talk to or connect with students and their families during this time is, have you had any experiences that are similar to this? Mm-hmm. Are there any ways in which, you know, do you have people in your life who you connect with and communicate with over long distances? What do you know? What could you teach us? I think we have to constantly push ourselves toward surfacing strengths that we don't even know are there.
I appreciate the focus on the growth mindset and moving away from starting with what's missing or what's challenging, because that's my initial instinct. And I think a lot of teachers we work with do come to the work from that growth mindset perspective. And at the same time, right now, there are just so many things that they feel like aren't working. And I feel like they're realizing these things were not working before, and that's why they're not working now. And I think it comes back to what you were saying earlier about the child and their family being known. So maybe there wouldn't be such a struggle or an anxiousness about what's not working right now if we knew our kids and their families better.
Yeah.
Just something I'm thinking about it from my own perspective.
Yeah.
So right now, where do you see opportunities for teachers to bring equity to the forefront of conversation and action? Or is it even the right time to do that, thinking about what everybody is experiencing, stress and trauma and all the feelings that everyone is having right now?
I think the most important thing for us to be thinking about right now is how do we create equitable access and experiences and opportunities. I think there's nothing more important for us to think about. And we have a perfect opportunity to do so. This is the... You know, this morning, I was talking to one of my dearest friends in the world who is a Kenyan woman. She lives in Nairobi. I have partnered with her and the communities that she supports for many years now, and I'm deeply inspired by and committed to the work she does in those communities. And I was talking to her this morning, and She's a leader in education, and she was talking about the incredible challenges and struggles. I mean, these are communities where now that they're on lock, or they're not supposed to go out and they can't leave, they're literally communities where people survive day to day. They go out, they work, they earn $2 or $3, they buy some maize, they eat, they go out the next day. And so she was talking about how you know, right now it's hunger, it will soon be starvation, the fear and the devastation in that sense in those communities. And she also said multiple times, as I was talking about the challenges I'm experiencing, she kept saying, we've had hard times before. This reminds me of the year 2004 when this happened, or the year this when that happened. She said, we've had hard times before. And that reminder that many of the communities that we're supporting in the US that we think are, you know, that we're concerned about, like, many of these communities have had hard times. And how can we tap into and be reminded of that resilience? Perhaps some of us are feeling like this is the hardest thing I've ever gone through, and this is mind-boggling hard for everybody. And there, people have had incredibly hard challenges before. Right now, I feel like we are in a situation in which things are just crumbling, right? Everything is so uncertain. The way that we have done things is crumbling. We don't know what's next. And so there is possibility. There's possibility for us to do things differently in terms of how we teach, how we relate to students, how we engage their families. I was talking to a teacher last week who was saying, for example, that she's been noticing that her introverted students are showing up to virtual learning in a much more engaged, verbal, vocal way than she's ever seen them. And she was saying, like, I just don't know what's going on. I don't know how to understand this, but they're like so engaged and chatty and present, and I feel them in a different way. And she was also talking about how her English learners were, this is a class that she's had for almost 2 years now, so there's a lot of trust built between them, but the way that they were showing up differently and perhaps more engaged, differently engaged, more playful, they're at home, they're in a space where they feel some sense of comfort and security. I think we have to, again, be open to, we have to question our own assumptions. And we have to be thinking about and looking for what is possible. What can we do that we've never done before? How can we recenter the individual child? So the teacher I was talking to last week was also saying she's been really questioning what lessons to do now that in California there's going to be no state testing. No one is like walking into her classroom making sure she's on the right unit, that she's saying the right things. You know, I was like, yes, you have this space for autonomy that you've been craving for so long. You know your students better than anybody else. What could you do right now? How could you really rethink instruction and learning and community? And her students are, again, I think there's an opportunity for us to really rethink, what is education? What do we see as the role of schools? What is schooling? What is the knowledge that our students have to get? How do we rethink what that knowledge is, what it could be? Right? What is the knowledge that we most value? And I would say equity is about, again, going back to equity, is about knowing and being known. It's about valuing who we are and what we bring, the strengths we bring. If I was a teacher right now, I'd be doing extensive storytelling, invitation of storytelling, building community, creating spaces for vulnerability and courage. How do we build our resilience, our emotional intelligence, our community? How do we create a virtual campfire, and let's go back 50,000 years or 10,000 or 6,000 or 400, and let's sit around a fire and tell some stories so that we can know and be known. Because you know what we've done for the last few hundred years or 100 years in education, it really hasn't worked that well. It's really got a problematic track record. And so let's try something different. Human beings actually, you know, there's a lot of systems of oppression that don't want us to know this, but human beings did actually pretty well for thousands of years in small communities telling each other stories. So let's try something different.
This actually makes me really excited. And I know that, you know, there are so many challenges and new things that teachers are learning on the fly right now. And at the same time, I've been able to be a part of conversations with administrators and with teachers who are echoing that sentiment of like, look, we don't have our state tests and we're in this new situation. What can we do? What is possible? And I think it's definitely a challenging time in education. It's also a really exciting time, I think. And I don't know, I don't like to think of myself as pessimistic, but I want to think about how are we going to carry this back into our school buildings. And when you think about recentering the individual child and hearing everyone's story and knowing everyone's story, whose voices do you think we need to be listening to right now to make sustainable changes to our system?
That's a good question. I'd say let's just start with the people who haven't had a chance to tell their stories. Communities that have been marginalized, those that have been in this country, in the US, for hundreds of years. Let's listen to the people who were here, who've been here for thousands and thousands of years, to those communities. Let's listen to folks who have gleaned knowledge from struggle in other countries and other places. I think there's opportunities. You know, just, I appreciate this conversation. It's allowing me to think about some things that I haven't really fully thought about. And just the, you know, right now, in terms of engaging virtually, the opportunity for us to be telling stories and sharing and verbally communicating and relying less on what we do, writing by hand or using worksheets or filling out, you know, even the more authentic sort of versions of worksheets. There's an opportunity for communities that have long histories and are skilled, I would say, in oral language and in storytelling to be honored. And for that's a skill set. I know that as someone who has become somebody who speaks a lot. It's a skill set to be able to use stories to share ideas and lessons and morals. And there are communities in the world that are so much more skilled at that than many of the sort of Western of European descent capitalist cultures that too many of us belong to or have been forced into. And I would say those, you know, all European cultures have a long history of storytelling and oral tradition. It's just that the timeline has been a little bit different. And
so this is kind of a personal question, but I think maybe some listeners can relate. What would your advice be for me, someone who is a member of dominant culture? What can my role be to ensure that those voices are invited to these conversations and valued and really amplified? Because I know that a lot of the administrators and teachers that we support also are members of white dominant culture. And what's our responsibility, or what can we do? Is there one first step you could recommend that we take? It's sometimes scary to begin because we don't know what's going to happen.
Sure. It's a great question. I mean, I would actually say the first thing is to ask the questions. Mm. Asking that question is the first step. And ask that question to a lot of people. Ask that question to, and again, like, I think we can ask that question to communities. There's so many of us that have been marginalized, right? And so the great majority of us have been marginalized for some identity marker or another. There's some groups that maybe haven't had as much marginalization, but I would say ask that question to the communities that you serve. And then the second part of that is listen and learn how to listen. Listening is a skill. Our listening is influenced by our distorted notions of others. So we have to actually learn and practice listening. Have some families or students or colleagues sit down and say, what is your advice to me? What do I do during this time? What do you want me to know? What have I not seen? What have I not heard? How can you be a leader in this time? What can you ask of me? What do I need to do to create space for you to step up? I found over and over that some of the most powerful experiences I had with the parents of students that I taught was when I created spaces for them to speak and when I listened. And yes, there's logistics. I taught many students who came from communities that where I didn't speak those languages, and I had to find interpreters or students interpreted for their parents. But creating spaces where you listen, where you ask some questions and you listen is really powerful.
I'm just going to put in a little plug for your work here, because I, for myself personally, the work that you share around listening and listening to your own listening was really huge for me as somebody who likes to talk and likes to make connection. Always listening to make connection was something that I realized about myself, and never truly listening to somebody, realizing that was a little bit shocking, but very helpful as a teacher. And I hope that more and more teachers will get into that practice of really listening to the kids and the families. Yeah. I'd like to switch to our other topic, kind of leading from equity. And you've talked about resilience a little bit, but I'm going to start the same way with resilience that I did with equity. What is resilience?
Resilience is the ability to bounce back after a challenge or a setback. Resilience is how we manage adversity. Resilience is emotional, intellectual, physical energy, skill set. Resilience is something that we can cultivate. Resilience is something that we cultivate or build through the things that we do every day, through our habits, as well as through our attitudes or our ways of being.
You mentioned emotional intelligence in that list. What are the main components of emotional intelligence that teachers can become more aware of in themselves in order to grow their resilience?
Emotional intelligence is defined as having four parts, and they're sequential. The first component is that you recognize and name and can know your own emotions when they come up. So you can say in a moment, or perhaps not too long afterwards, that's anger. I'm feeling angry. The second component of emotional intelligence is that you know how to manage that emotion or engage with it or navigate it. So that when you know, when you can sense the anger coming up, you know, whether it's like because a student rolls her eyes at you for the 14th time that day, that you have strategies to respond to that coming up in yourself, not to manage the student or to respond to student, but to manage your own emotional response of frustration or irritation or anger. The third part of emotional intelligence is that you recognize when other people are having emotions. And then the fourth part is that you know how to navigate or respond to their emotions. So for example, you recognize when a student is feeling really distraught or anxious or confused, and you know how to respond to that emotion that they're experiencing. So that's the definition of emotion, emotional intelligence. And you know, it's so powerful, and I think it's a lifelong journey for us to just be working on the first two pieces. The next two pieces will come inevitably, but to understand when we are experiencing emotions, what they are, and to have strategies to respond to them or engage with them is really powerful.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. That's a lot. When we're talking about naming emotions and then engaging with or responding to our own, if we just take those first two pieces and we're thinking about ourselves as teachers and administrators in a school building with kids, that's not a common practice. So what do you say to, that's my cat knocking stuff over. What do you say to teachers, administrators, or anybody who says that they think discussions of emotions are not professional or don't belong in our schools?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really common. Well, depending on what mood I'm in that day, I might sort of say to them like, okay, do you ever notice yourself or others having emotions? Like, do you think they exist? Right? So yes, depending on what mood I'm in. But sometimes I'll say that perhaps in a more, joking, teasing tone, because the reality is, like, emotions are all over the place all the time. And any school leader, any teacher knows that, right? Like, the kids come to school with emotions and they're all over the place. No matter what age, they're all over the place, which is great. Like, both the emotions are all over the place and the range of emotions is everywhere. And so it's sort of like, well, how's it working for us to say it's unprofessional, leave them at the door? Is that working? Or if I'm talking to a school leader, again, I might say, like, or in spite of you wishing that people would leave their emotions at the door, do teachers still show up with them? Do they still come to your office feeling angry about an email they got from a student's parent or feeling frustrated about a team meeting? Like, are you still seeing emotions? And so what are the options? Like, you want to just keep ignoring them and mandating that they don't exist? You know, and then I'll say, like, you know, this might be hard news, but we are human beings and human beings have emotions. And so we have a choice. Do we just keep saying, like, leave them outside the door if it's not really working? Or do we want to try some strategies for accepting and acknowledging and responding to emotions? Right? Because basically, we spend so much energy, some people spend so much energy trying to deny that emotions exist or push them out or keep them, you know, locked up or enclosed for one particular time of the day. All that energy is way more energy and time than it would actually take if we just said, all right, let's do some learning. You know, some places now are doing SEL, social emotional learning for kids. What if we did just a little bit of that for the adults and see what happens? Mm-hmm.
These are really timely questions and thoughts, because I know that, you know, districts, not just in New York where I am, but all over, everywhere, are talking about this, particularly for students now, and finally thinking, like, okay, what are we doing amongst ourselves? So let's move in that direction, mm-hmm. which is huge, I think. When you think about when you were a classroom teacher, what were some of the biggest challenges to your resilience?
I was probably my own biggest challenge. Like, I probably created so many of the obstacles to my resilience. And I say that because I was, this is probably still true today, like, I have such high expectations for myself. You know, I hold my standards for myself are so high. And so as a teacher, I was really self-critical. I just felt like I was never doing enough. Like, I could, you know, there was, the work of being a teacher is so overwhelming. It's so massive. It's so endless. And I remember just so many times when I beat myself up about what I was doing or what I wasn't doing. And that's why I say, I think, like, you know, that is the way things are for teachers. It will be that way. Life is hard. Life is overwhelming. Life is a never-ending list of things to take care of and do. And so we can practice self-compassion and kindness towards ourselves and acceptance. And at the same time, we can still strive for excellence and do our best. It's an attitude of acceptance and being kind to ourselves.
And that's kind of relating to my next question, is what role does self-reflection play in cultivating our resilience?
Self-reflection plays a tremendous role. It's what allows us to see where we need more love and kindness towards ourselves. It's what allows us to see, oh, I'm getting really stretched and exhausted, and I got to figure out how to put some boundaries up, how to step back, how to ask for help. It's the process through which we gain insight and make changes. So it's essential.
In your book Onward, you say dominant culture can make it hard for us to know ourselves. Can you elaborate on that for the listeners, especially as it relates to the pandemic we're living through right now?
Dominant culture can make it hard for us to know ourselves. Well, dominant culture has values, messages, values, for example, about productivity and what kind of products, what kind of activity is most valuable. And so sitting down and spending, you know, I'm going to go really wild here, like spending half an hour in either meditation or contemplation, reading poetry, whatever it is that helps you look inward, look bigger, and then perhaps journaling, calling a friend and talking about your insights and awareness about how you're responding to this crisis. Dominant culture doesn't value that because there's no product, there's no outcome, there's no deliverable, right? There's no, it's nothing that could be measured on a standardized test. And so the processes, sitting around and having conversations, telling stories, that's not valued by dominant culture. Dominant culture values, I mean, in this case, one of the first, thing that comes to my mind when I think about dominant culture in this context is a culture of capitalism and industrialization, and that's about productivity and getting a lot done. So telling stories, sitting around for hours and hours and telling stories during the workday, or taking a walk with somebody, even if it's like you're talking to them on the phone while you're taking a walk, dominant culture doesn't value that we take care of our bodies. It just wants us to work really hard and produce. So this is an opportunity right now. I think there's an incredible opportunity for us to reclaim our right to sleep and rest and make our own meals at home that are healthy. And I was talking to some teachers this morning and I said, you know, what's a bright spot for you from this week? And one of them said, I love eating breakfast at home. Mm-hmm. And said, like, for 15 years, I've been eating breakfast while I drive in the car on the way to work. And that's usually, you know, kind of scarfing down a piece of toast. And so this is a joy. Like, we should be able to eat breakfast at home.
I love that. And you touched on something that for me was really a personal aha moment when I was reading Onward. You tell a story about a principal who had an interaction with a teacher that left her in distress. And you asked her what she was sensing in her body. And she said, I have no idea. I don't live in my body. And for me, I was like, that's me. That is me. I never thought of it that way. And you touched on a couple of things that you think maybe teachers could do right now. Do you have any other advice for teachers who, like me, haven't been living in their bodies and are carrying so much stress and overwhelm right now? What advice would you give to teachers who have been living in their heads for so long?
Oh, you know, the first thing I would do is just validate and perhaps appreciate that you recognize that. Like, I actually think it takes courage to say, I haven't been living in my body. Just that statement reflects a desire to reconnect and to live in it. Like, that right there is a huge, it's almost like the classic, like, you've just named you had a problem. Okay. That was half the battle. It makes me feel like I want to do a whole session on like reclaiming the right to live in your body and what does that look like and how do you do that? Mm-hmm. And I would just start with saying, like, it's the most true thing we have in a sense. Like, we know we have our bodies, right? some of us might be questioning, do we have a spirit? Do we have emotions? Like, even do we have a brain? Do we have a mind? Like, sometimes that's a bizarre concept to me, but like, we know we've got a body. So what would it be like to live in it? And how do we reconnect? And I would say we want to always be drawn by the strengths, the possibility, the opportunity, the joy, the pleasure. So I would say where I'm sure in your life, even in recent times, you have found some way to find pleasure in your body, whether that is by like when you finally lie down in bed, you're like, oh, my pillow, you know, or you take shoes off that aren't comfortable. Or now, like, I am living in, I have such epiphanies about what I wear, what I dress, like, right? It's so comfortable. Yeah. Why have I not been living in my stretchy elastic pants forever? You know, I don't know if this is like too much information for listeners, but bras. Can we talk about why we wear bras with uncomfortable underwires or uncomfortable shoes? This is like a whole, you know, on Zoom, we get dressed from the waist up. And so there's a lot of like, what do I look like from the waist up? But I think there's opportunities for all kinds of epiphanies right now, like about this physical body that we live in, this experience, and a potential for embracing what it feels like to get more sleep or to take a bath because we have more time right now, or to rub our feet just because it feels good. I think you've really inspired me. I want to do a whole session.
I'm sure I would attend for sure.
I'll add that to the calendar.
Great. You research and teach about dispositions we can hold in order to grow our resilience. And I would like to talk a little bit about the disposition of empowerment, because I feel like it's one that maybe a lot of people aren't feeling right now. What role does empowerment play in building resilience? And what can teachers do right now to grow their own sense of power when things seem so out of control?
One of the resources I share a lot that people can download from my website is the spheres of influence. It's not a concept that I came up with, but I don't know who did. I haven't been able to find out, but it is one that I reference and use all the time. And it's a real simple concept that many people have heard about, right? What is in your sphere of influence? What's in your sphere of control? What's outside of it? And just holding that question and exploring that is empowering, because we can start making some distinctions between all the stuff that we can't control, and perhaps maybe what we can, or maybe what we can influence. And I think that there's opportunities every moment and every day for us to feel a greater sense of control. It's just that we don't often register, okay, that was a moment where I was exercising my autonomy or my agency, and that allows me to feel more empowered. Really, like whether it's what we're wearing or how we're engaging with students in a virtual classroom, whatever that is, or what we eat for breakfast, those are opportunities for us to exercise influence or control.
And then switching our perspective from ourselves to others, how can we make space for our students and their families to cultivate their own empowerment right now?
I think raising these questions with students, what do you feel like is within your control or influence right now? Students are, I mean, even little tiny children, they're really sharp. We underestimate their wisdom and their knowledge. So asking them, inviting them into that conversation. You know, ultimately, the only thing we can really control to some extent, you know, I would say control, perhaps sometimes it feels like influence, is our emotions and our disposition and our attitude. And so that's why it goes back to emotional intelligence and learning and understanding our emotions so that we can exercise, so we can feel more empowered, more influence.
Mm. what's boosting your resilience these days? I do follow you on Instagram, so I've seen some of your posts, but what's boosting your resilience during this time?
Yeah, it's really pushing me to remember everything I know about resilience. So I would say being really aware of what I'm feeling and registering it and accepting it and acknowledging it and remembering that every emotion is like a weather pattern and it shifts and changes, and finding moments of joy and pleasure and bright spots, what I call bright spots. So even right now I'm talking to you and I'm looking out my office window and I just noticed a little hummingbird come and sit on a tree branch, and being able to say, oh, that's beautiful, that's so sweet, brings me one little tiny drop of the positive kind of energy that builds resilience. I'm really enjoying having more time to read literature, and so I've been just loving being immersed in some great novels. Finding sweet moments with my family, being appreciative of those moments that I otherwise wouldn't have had. Those are some of the things.
I love that. And I think sometimes maybe we think of resilience as just like this huge thing, when in reality, it just takes moments here and there, like you just described, to build it up, which I think makes it really accessible to anybody, even if they feel like they're not at their best and they're not feeling resilient.
Right. That's why resilience is cultivated by about 100,000 different little things that we can do every day. And so if we're practicing those, we may in the moment not feel resilient. That's okay. That's actually part of knowing about what resilience is sometimes you go through those lows when you feel like I'm not resilient. And then the next day you realize you're up and you're doing your things, and you are, you're more resilient than you think. Hmm.
What's the connection between equity and resilience?
Well, resilience, I mean, we need resilience to create equitable communities, and equitable communities are resilient. So there's an interconnection between them that characterizes the journey and the destination. In order for us to create equitable spaces, it's going to be a journey, and there's going to be some really hard parts and some rocky moments. And so we're going to need resilience, and we're going to need to really be honing our resilience. And to create equity, we're going to need to learn a whole lot more about what resilience means to other communities and how to listen and appreciate theirs.
Oh, there's a lot to think about. Can we get a teaser for what we will learn from Coaching for Equity when it's released this summer?
Yes. Coaching for Equity actually is a lot of stories. and it's a lot of stories about the conversations which move us towards more equitable practices. And there is a framework for how to coach for equity, how to have conversations about race, how to have healing conversations, but it's really a lot of stories so that we can practice listening to each other and holding space for the stories to come out.
I can't wait. Elena, where can people find the work that you have created with so many people and you've shared with all of us? Where can they find what you share with us?
My website is a great place to start, and that is brightmorningteam.com. And on my website, you can find links to the social media sites that we participate in. You can find the lots of free coaching tools that we offer. You can find all the information about webinars and other virtual learning opportunities that we have to offer. So that's where I would start. It's the easiest way to find us on social media.
Great. We will definitely link to that when we post this episode. And I know that my whole team is just huge fans of the work that you and your team do, and that your work has really impacted the way that we work with teachers and the way that we work together as a team. So we're just so, there's no way I can say how grateful we are that you agreed to have this conversation today. And I'm really thankful to be able to represent my team and the teachers that I work with.
You're welcome. I really appreciated the conversation and the questions. And yes, thank you for the invitation again.
Thank you for coming on. And we'll let you know when the episode posts, and I'll tweet about it and share out. And hopefully some of your other fans and followers and students will enjoy listening to our conversation too.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guests we had on today's episode, or any of the resources we discussed, please find those on our webpage. This podcast is produced by Midstate Arburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Sunbeam from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.